Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And happy Tuesday, everyone. Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review Online. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, good to have you back from the Columbus Day break. And also good to see more Democrats being suckered in by the Occupy Wall Street movement and these hundreds of people. And it really is down to hundreds of people at the most in some of these places who still don't really know what they want. They just know that rich people are bad. And today they're going up to literally protest at the front doors of rich people like Rupert Murdoch and Jamie Dimon, who I'm pretty sure aren't going to be home. But, you know, it's a good way to waste a day if you got nothing better to do, I guess. And so you got Nancy Pelosi scolding Eric Cantor for slamming these people who are soiling the parks in New York City and smelling up the whole lower Manhattan area. But somehow she thinks that he still needs to apologize for the Tea Partiers who didn't really spit on black members of Congress back during the health care debate. Apparently, she's still perpetrating that lie, but it's still kind of the more radical members of the Democratic Congress who are lining up behind these people. The rank and file are still, I think, pretty hesitant. You got folks like Ed Rendell saying it's time for them to go home. So I'm not sure how many more are going to pile on here, but if the Democrats align themselves in any meaningful way with these people, that can only be good news for Republicans next year.
I think you're right, Greg. One of the things I would note is it's kind of, I noticed on last Friday, there was this kind of this perfect inverse of the reaction to the two movements that whenever you see a big group of people and they're chanting something you like, then it is democracy in action. It's just an example of energized grassroots. Whenever you see a big group of people chanting something you don't like, it is an angry mob that is out of control and must be, you know, denounced immediately. And so I guess I kind of see a little bit of hypocrisy on both sides of this. Having said that, I don't think I've ever heard any report of a Tea Partier attempting to defecate on a police car.
I'm pretty sure
and that, to
right.
me, is kind of what these protests are all about. I kind of put the devil's advocate earlier this morning when I had talked to Patrick Hines, who's a political strategist. He was most recently working for Tim Pawlenty and worked on the McCain campaign in 08. And he was actually kind of warning conservatives not to underestimate the Occupy Wall Street crowd. Not so much that they're really representative of the mainstream or anything like that, but just observing that with these protests, they've gotten their agenda front and center. 3 years of high unemployment, Americans are just angry. And right now the attempt of the Occupy Wall Street crowd is to say, don't blame Obama, don't blame government, don't blame the public sector, let's blame those darn rich people. And Patrick's a little worried that that may catch on. He also notes that so many young people who have not found jobs, as they leave college and into the workforce in the past couple of years, they have no experience in the private sector. So they don't see any particular loyalty to it or value to it or anything like that. I think that's something worth noting. Having said that, Ed Rendell, former Pennsylvania governor, is saying on Laura Ingraham's show that it's really about time for these folks to go home. They've made their point. And the idea that this going on and on, there's only two things that can happen. It can either wither out or it can get even more violent than it has been so far. It can get even more extreme. In the New York Times today, some unnamed Democratic strategist says he's worried about garbage cans going through windows. I guess he's been watching probably Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing or something like that. So a lot of potential for this to go wrong for the Democrats. And I don't think these protests have really put forth the most mainstream image they could. And my guess is there's a lot of people who are seeing kind of echoes of 1968 in this.
I think you're right. I also think your point about the law-abiding nature of the Tea Party is a good one. And
don't poop on cops would strike me as a really good Republican, you know, slogan for 2012. I mean, you know, if one party is clearly the do not defecate on police cruisers party and the other party is the defecate on police cruisers, I like that odds. I like that framing, Greg. I just have this good feeling about that.
I think so. And I think most Republicans have done a pretty good job of explaining more what the protesters have really been about than what the protesters even realize that they're about. So that's been a good to see. On to martini number two now. And Jim, once again, sponsored by the Middle East, as it was for many days throughout the spring and early summer with the Libya situation. But we go back to an even earlier story, and that's the situation in Egypt, because you had these mass revolts in Tahrir Square, and Mubarak had to go because he's abridging the rights of the people, and he probably was in many different ways. But one thing he wasn't doing was slaughtering religious minorities by the dozens, and apparently now with the military either not being able to do anything about it or choosing not to do anything about it as they get ready for the upcoming elections, the Coptic Christians, one of the oldest sects of Christianity, being absolutely persecuted, their churches being torched and they turn out in the streets to protest, hey, look what's happening to us, and lo and behold, they get mowed down. So that's very troubling, and so is the reports, the way they're constructed from a lot of people saying this Muslim-Christian violence needs to stop in a very vague way. Other reporters have done a very good job of explaining who's exactly perpetrating the violence, but either way, it's clearly not what I think the vast majority of the folks who were protesting back in February envisioned just a few months later.
No, I think you're right, Greg. And I guess the good way of summarizing all this is to say that the Arab Spring has become the Coptic winter. Mm. And it's one of those things where I realize the United States does not have an enormous amount of leverage in these circumstances. And I understand that Obama came out with his pro forma denunciation of the violence. But it kind of reveals just kind of the state of things right now, that this is not even really a top-tier news story. That this is, you know, very much a foreign pages news story. The entire Arab Spring, or at least a probably the most vivid example of the Arab Spring turning sour, would seem to be a very big challenge to U.S. foreign policy vision. And I know we're not in the democracy promotion business anymore. Obama pretty much drove a stake through the heart of that notion. But it just kind of seems like, well, now we're seeing some of the worst impulses that we feared this revolution was going to unleash taking hold in the most populous Arab nation, and I'm not seeing a great deal of U.S. influence being brought to bear on this. I guess we're telling the Coptic Christians of Egypt that they're on their own, and you can only see things getting worse in the Middle East if this phenomenon accelerates in the months ahead.
Yeah, the Obama statement in reaction to the violence was, I guess weak would be the most polite way to say it, that, you know, the moving forward, we need to make sure everything's fair and just, and minorities have a voice. Well, you know, well, yeah, thanks for that.
Minorities do have a voice. They're saying, ah, stop killing us.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, one of the reasons the president perhaps is a little bit out of touch on what's going on there and, well, with our economy and a lot of other things is, according to a New York Post columnist, Jim, apparently he doesn't really enjoy doing his job much anymore. He's apparently cutting out most days at about 4 o'clock, doesn't really talk to anyone except Valerie Jarrett and David Axelrod. People as high up as Geithner and Hillary Clinton feel like he's freezing them out and doesn't even really get their opinion when making major decisions. So I've got a lot of people wondering whether he's just going into his own little cocoon and whether he's actually having psychological problems. I think that is a little bit over the top. I think he's probably feeling sorry for himself because his policies have failed and people are actually blaming him for that. This is a guy who I'm sure is going to go out there full throttle because his own reputation's on the line over the next 12 months.
You know, Greg, it's interesting. As I saw this story, I thought back to something I'd observed back in 2008. You look over the course of Barack Obama's career. He's elected to the state Senate, and less than 2 years later, he starts running for the U.S. House. He does not win that race. 2 years later, he starts running for the U.S. Senate. Now, that's about almost 2 years before Election Day and before the, you know, almost about a year and a half before the Democratic primary. Spends an enormous amount of time running for the U.S. Senate, is elected in 2004, then spends about 2 years in the Senate, and then he starts running for president of the United States. So every 2 to 3 years, Barack Obama gets bored with the job that he's in and begins running for some higher office. And now he's hit the ceiling. There is no higher office for him to run for other than maybe Pope or U.N. General Secretary or something like that. So I kind of have this feeling that this is, you know, there was a joke when Obama was running for office that if he serves the full 4 years, it'll be the longest time he's ever had a job. And that's a slight exaggeration when you look at his time in the state Senate, et cetera. But it will be the longest amount of time he's gone without trying to get another job. And I kind of wonder if at some point he's just kind of hit some sort of barrier. He kind of, look, we've said that he's now in full campaign mode. We know that he's not really seriously looking for a deal with Boehner. We know that he kind of knows that this jobs bill is going nowhere, et cetera. So when we mock him for not governing, in his mind, why should he govern? What's he going to get done in the next, you know, year and change? And I think he kind of recognizes that there isn't much to do that. I do want to have one slight quibble with that New York Post article, which said that he's not working after 4 p.m. on weekdays. Greg, that's absolute nonsense. He does lots of campaign fundraisers late at night, sometimes 2 at night. So don't tell me this guy's not working nights and burning the midnight oil. This guy will go out before an adoring crowd of donors anytime he needs to and hear people tell them how great he is and applaud him and every word he says and all that stuff. So don't, you know, I actually had speculated, considering Obama's significant fundraising advantages heading into the 2012 cycle and the advantages of incumbency, et cetera, it's surprising that Team Obama said they needed $1 billion and that they were setting the bar so high. Greg, every once in a while I start wondering, do you think maybe these fundraisers are kind of a form of therapy for Obama? That he encounters, you know, he goes to the town hall, And, you know, that woman told him she was tired of defending him. And everywhere he, you know, I'm sure that the Oval Office meetings are not constantly cheery. He doesn't get to watch, you know, Rahm Emanuel cursing somebody out to entertain him anymore. And so he needs these things, I suspect. I think he needs to go into a room and have everyone tell him how great he's doing, because he sure as heck isn't seeing these things in the polls and the other usual indicators of presidential approval.
Yeah, I think in addition to maintaining power, maintaining the size of his ego is right up there on the priority list. And these are huge ways to make sure that he at least still thinks extremely highly of himself, even if he won't talk to anybody other than Valerie Jarrett and David Axelrod about it. But very interesting. Who knows how much of it is true, but it seems like it's pretty well sourced, even though there were no actual names in there.
It feels plausible in light of what we're seeing with this White House.
It certainly does. Jim, enjoy the new presidential debate tonight. I'm sure Herman Cain will have a podium closer to the middle since the last one. That's usually the way it goes. And if you can get Bloomberg, good for you. Others, wait till next week. It's on CNN.
It is. I understand that the positioning will have Romney, Perry, and Kane in the middle, and Huntsman is actually going to be off stage, I understand, somewhere in the wings. So, hello? Can you hear me? Yeah, yeah. I just wish that the debate were televised tonight. I just understand it's on Bloomberg. And a shame that no one will actually be watching it. You know, that'll be the night that Perry has his big comeback.
Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.